Welcome to everybody. My name is Jeff Gedman, and I'm the director of the Falcon Nest. It's good to see so many friends and some new guests as well. There's lots to say, but I don't get to say it because Hal Williams is moderating the discussion this evening and does it so beautifully. I will say that I'm delighted that we have a chance to host our guest of honor tonight, David Skinner, who I have known and admired for years, starting when he was an editor and writer of the Weekly Standard magazine, and now in his latest role as an editor of an important magazine called Humanities. He's a terribly bright and interesting thinker and has lots of... I'll stop there because Hal's giving more than I can say. I'm not supposed to do that, so I'm not gonna go there. And then also Peter Pomerantsev, who is right there, who is going to be a respondent, is a fabulous journalist with kind of one foot in Britain and another foot, so to speak, in Russia, and equally interesting. And I won't interest you either because Hal has the honors. It's a terrific book. I have read it. I commend it to you. The story of eight. It's language, it's grammar, it's linguistics, it's cultural history in the United States. We have a few copies we're happy to share with you tonight. But let me stop there and just say welcome. I'm delighted you're here. And how to the real meat and framing the evening and discussions, introducing the guests, over to you.
Thank you very much. Well, when we were children, we all knew that we thought like children, and then we grew up and we started speaking like grown-ups. And we all know in our own particular histories that language evolves, but who's to say what's the right direction of evolution and what, or who is to say what is the correct use of language and what counts as correct usage of language. Now, this great debate, which is sometimes rather technically referred to as a debate between prescriptivists and descriptivists, is the subject of David Skinner's marvellous book, The Story of Ain't, which is the story partly of lexicography, but also, as Jeff said earlier, it's also an important part of the American cultural story in the middle of the 20th century. When Webster's third international dictionary was about to be published in 1961, publishers Merriam and Co. Produced a press release which defined ain't as a contraction used by educated Americans. And many educated Americans raised their hands in horror at that thought. Or as one American journalist of the time said, educated my foot. Now the point about Webster's was that it included quotations, affirmations, descriptions of linguistic usage by such great American thinkers as Betty Grable. And it was, and Mickey Spillane, I think, as well. And David Skinner, who, as Jeff said, has come to us from Washington this evening to prompt our thoughts on this issue, has had great success with this book, The Story of Ain't, and I recommend it heartily to all of you. And over to David, and welcome to the Legatum Institute.
Thanks for having me. Thanks to Jeff. Thanks to all of you turning down a chance to be at some sunny beach and instead to be here with me in London discussing dictionaries. I'm really pleased to be here. Let's see, when I started this book some years ago, I got asked to, am I speaking loudly enough? I got asked to join the usage panel for the American Heritage Dictionary, a very good dictionary, and I started getting these questionnaires about various usages that were disputed and argued about, and I just had the feeling that I didn't really know enough about this this subject to offer a really learned opinion. Excuse me. So I looked for an opportunity to write something longer on the subject, and I learned about this controversy which happened in 1961. Merriam-Webster, the great publisher of American dictionaries, brought out its massive master volume, Webster's Third Unabridged, and it caused an unprecedented controversy. It became the most controversial dictionary ever, pretty much in weeks. It started with this press release, and it involved a lot of highly cantankerous commentary on everything from using as a conjunction to the dictionary's defining style, to the number of pronunciations it offered in its various attempts to be comprehensively representative of pronunciation and the language as it is actually used. But as I looked at the controversy and I wrote about it and I researched it some more, I became pretty firmly convinced that this wasn't a story about who's right, whether you should split an infinitive or... it was really, it really was a cultural story, and in a way, it was a cultural story about culture itself, and about what it sort of means to be cultivated. It's also a story about two different dictionaries, Webster's Third, and its much stuffier, more officious, more polite predecessor, Webster's Second. And so I ended up researching both dictionaries and the people who made them and how they made them and their views on the world. And so I started with Webster's Second, which came out in 1934. And it was edited by a man named William Allen Nielsen. He was a Scottish-born professor of English at Smith College. Actually, he was a president of Smith College when he was editor of Webster's Second. And he was sort of puritanical. He had edited some editions of 15th century British poetry, which he carefully battled the rise to take out the dirty words. He had been the assistant editor on something called the Harvard Classics, which is a set of great works of Western literature. And he had argued with his boss that they should take the dirty parts out of Shakespeare. He was kind of an urbane fellow, could be very witty, but he had definite views about proper English. And those views, in many ways, became the views of Webster II. Webster II was also a sort of product of its time in that they thought it was possible for it to cover everything. It called itself a universal dictionary. And without apology, it said it was the supreme authority on everything worth knowing. One of the reporters who went to the publication party for Webster II came back to his desk at the newspaper office and tried to stump the dictionary, asking, what was the Battle of Marne, and who's the 30th, who's the 16th president, and just one thing after another, trying to stump the dictionary. And this dictionary had not only all the common terms of the language, but it had all the characters in Shakespeare, all the characters in Dickens, all the names in the Bible, all the major wars and treaties, and had a huge section on sort of very important people in history, from Turkish pashas to Austrian dukes to a really incredible number of 19th century British essays. It was sort of the genteel American's view of culture as high culture. It had no naughty words. When it described a grammatical rule, it did so in a fashion that would not offend your school teacher. It was the prescriptivist dictionary. It was all-knowing and indisputable. But a lot was going on in American culture in these years. In the 20s and the 30s, the greatest innovations going on in American English involved slang. And literary writers, too, were turning away from sort of polite example and anglophonic usage to sort of explore the American dialect. If you read writers like William Faulkner or John Steinbeck, you find a kind of mix of sort of proletarian sympathy and genuine excitement about American English as Americans spoke it, as field hands spoke it, as circuit preachers spoke it, as just everyone spoke it, as the middle class spoke it. And at the same time, it's not only literary writers who are looking to sort of humbler forms of American English to produce, all sorts of exciting aesthetic effects. Linguists, scholars of language, are also studying it in a very different manner. And they're basically starting a very big fight with school teachers, with grammarians, with the kind of authorities who might turn to Webster Second for the final word on whether split and infinitive. These linguists often called structural linguists, include such figures as, in my book anyway, the ones that I talk about are mainly American, Leonard Bloomfield and Charles Carpenter Frees. Charles Carpenter Frees says something very controversial in these years, which is he says basically that there can never be in language something that is both a mistake and very common. If it is very common, it's not a mistake. If native speakers are always saying that, it's not wrong. That's the language. He sort of pursues this line of thought and sort of evangelical furor. He basically tries to re-describe American English from scratch, empirically, carefully, without sort of undue bias handed down from generations of of grammarians and usage snobs, and he ends up influencing one person in particular, who is Philip Gove, who becomes the editor of Webster's Third. And one of the things that's very interesting to me about Philip Gove was, unlike every other editor person who had been chosen to edit a Webster's dictionary — Webster's is, by the way, the great brand of American dictionaries. There's, it's the brand. So Philip Gove is selected to be editor-in-chief, and he's pretty much the first person in a very long time who's not already a public figure. He's not a college president who sort of stops in the office, every other Tuesday to offer his pronouncements on what the lexicographers really should have done. He's actually a professional lexicographer. He's not a name. He's not a famous person who they're just paying a fee to sort of front them and to defend them if necessary. He's a technocrat. He's someone who wanted to be a lexicographer. He had worked as an English teacher at NYU, but after the war, he decided he'd want to go back to academia, and he started applying. He had done scholarship on Samuel Johnson and some other dictionary-type subjects. But he became a sort of staff editor. And at some point, Miriam decided that they didn't want some famous name to front their work, to represent them. So they just sort of hired the most qualified person in the building, who happened to be this man, Philip Gove, who has a sort of terrific tenure for politics, and a real kind of insider's knowledge of the dictionary, and an insider's view of the dictionary. If there's out there, outside their building, some public expecting that Miriam is going to again present their dictionary as the supreme authority on every thing worth knowing, he was maybe the last person you should have hired. So he has a very different view of the language. He brings in as many dirty words as he can, and he rewrites all the usage notes for things like split infinitives and shall and will and all sorts of things. For space reasons, he had to drop all the encyclopedic material on British essayists and old kings and figures in Shakespeare and Dickens. And it becomes a sort of linguistically pure dictionary. It's more scholarly in its methods. It's more scientific in its approach to the language. But it is, without quite realizing it, starting a fight. And you can see it in one of Philip Gove's most famous statements, which is that his dictionary, Webster's Third, would have no traffic with artificial notions of correctness or superiority. And the controversy gets started when they're bringing out the dictionary. They sent out a press release, and Hal's right, they quote from the usage note for ain't, which says that ain't is, they actually slightly misword it, and they selectively quote it to get like the most fightingest nub of it, which is, they say, ain't is used orally in most parts of the U.S. by cultivated speakers. it's interesting, sort of in the lifetime of people alive in 1961, cultivated had always been a kind of very serious thing. William Allen Nielsen had once discussed what is a cultivated man. He was the editor of Webster's Second, and he said. And he had to make the argument that you didn't necessarily need to know Greek or Latin to be cultivated. But suddenly, we're going from this sort of classical model of education and what it means to be knowledgeable to a very different time. Science counts for a lot more. and popular culture counts for a lot more. And suddenly, Merriam-Webster, of all institutions, is saying that ain't is cultivated, which is just crazy. I mean, generations of teachers, American teachers, have been teaching their students and nagging their students to never say ain't. At the beginning of my book, there's something called Good Grammar Week, which was instituted by the National Council of Teachers of English. And it was a week, it was a sacred week, in which all students would be asked to not say ain't, and to not split a preposition. And if they did their job well, at the end of that week, they'd be entertained by skits in which the hero, Mr. Dictionary, comes in and slays the villain ain't. ain't had as bad a reputation in English as possible. Its history is longer and more interesting than this suggests, but certainly for at least 100 years it was a bad word. Between these two dictionaries, a lot had changed in America. You know, America had made it through the Great Depression, through World War II. I mean, if you look at the different presidents of these eras, they're so different. If you look at World War I, you have Woodrow Wilson, who's trying to implore the world to play nice. It's, you know, American leadership amounts to the 14 points, this sort of rhetorical embellishment given to a Europe begging for it. But by the 50s, America's, you know, a legitimate world leader and has actually a great deal to be proud of in terms of its literature and its artistic exports. We're a lot more scientifically minded. We've become a sort of more middle class country, a country with a lot of engineers, and with a great middle class and a great market economy in the post war years. We're somehow prouder in a lot of ways, and this seems to be sort of part of it. We're suddenly going to describe our own language a little more honestly, or a lot more honestly. But then there's an incredible backlash. The press release comes out, scores of newspapers mock the dictionary, mock this news about ain't suddenly being good English, ain't no longer a bad word. I mean, you can imagine, headline writers had a field day with it. In newspapers across the country, and this was followed by a sort of second wave of criticism among more literary writers who piled on this dictionary. At first, it seemed to be a sort of few hysterical newspaper editorialists who greeted the news about ain't as if it were the end of the world. They seemed to be maybe a minority, but that's not how the controversy played out. In fact, there sort of more and more intellectual power lined up behind the idea that this dictionary was a sort of sign of the apocalypse. Wilson Follett in the Atlantic Monthly called it a great calamity and called its editors saboteurs because they were trying to destroy the English language. Dwight MacDonald in The New Yorker compared it to the end of the world. He quotes from Shakespeare, from Troilus and Cressida, this great speech describing the seas rising to swallow up the shore. And, you know, governments and laws and rules meaning nothing anymore. And sort of man feeding on man like wolf upon wolf. You know, we're all reduced to this incredible state of nature because of what might at worst be called a crappy dictionary. So that's basically the story of my book. It's about the rise of linguistics and shifts in American culture toward a more sort of democratic standards, toward more scientific standards of knowledge, and it's about the sort of comedy of people getting very upset about language, because one of the constants of linguistic and usage history is that we all have incredibly strong feelings. You know, even the most scientifically detached among us have very strong feelings about other people's usage, and in this case, it seemed like the great authority on American usage and on American vocabulary was, you know, as the New York Times put it, surrendering to the permissive school. So it's had some consequences, including like an attempted takeover of Merriam-Webster, and many people sort of calling on Merriam-Webster to take back the dictionary and start over. It also helped inspire the existence of the birth of another dictionary called the American Heritage Dictionary, which is usually considered the more conservative dictionary. That's what I got. That's the story of my book. And
thank you very much indeed. It's a wonderful introduction to our theme discussion because it combines both the seriousness of language and the high comedy of language, and both of those sides of language are reflected in your book, David. And perhaps we get hot under the collar about language because language and the way we speak, our accents and our self-projection, they're bound up with our sense of ourselves as worthy, dignified, authoritative people, as we see in all of these evenings when we congregate as a summer here at the Gotham Institute. Now, I'm going to ask Peter Pramonso to do a sort of semi-formal response to. The point about Peter is that he knows about Russia and he knows about England, and he knows about the Russian use of language and he knows about the English use of language. And his lively journalistic mind, I know, will have been stirred by what he's just heard. So he's going to start our discussion this evening. Peter, over to you.
Right, no, thank you very much. I think what I have to say is sort of a hyperlink to what you've been talking about. So, of course, we've really been talking about is how English has been, you took away our beautiful language, you started doing something strange with it in America. But, of course, the story of English doesn't sort of stop there. And it's, you know, now we have this phenomenon where English is in some way hegemonic, but maybe not as quite as much as we think across the world. And I just got back from the covering the Russian protests for various publications. And there's actually a linguistic way to look at the whole Russian protest movement. So it's known as the rebellion of the creativne class, the creative class. This is a word that basically, I'm going to go out on a limb here because there are so many Russian experts in the room. I don't think creativne class existed around 3 years ago in Russia. It's a completely new term. And it's sort of associated with iPhones, with a certain way of dressing, with a certain hipster mentality. It's sort of an aesthetic revolution that's going on in Russia. And what I saw very much as I wandered around the process was this desperate search for new English words to help express a political position vis-a-vis Putin. Now, why can't they use the old ones? Why can't they say, you know, obviously not an English word, democracy, but certainly in Russia, it's associated with Western, sort of some sort of Anglo-Saxon values. So what we saw after, I think, 1989, was how a certain Western political vocabulary had a very, very sad story. So just take the word democracy. Very soon it became known as democracy, shitocracy. Literally, that's what it went. This is when the whole democratic revolution didn't go quite to plan. But then even more painfully, the word democratic began to mean cheap. So if you went to a really bad restaurant, you'll go, it's a really democratic restaurant. It's awful. But that was kind of, that was the low point of the word democratic, which had, you know, meant all these wonderful, wonderful things. At the same time, it had a very, very crafty, clever kind of Kremlin who was taking all these hip and fashionable Western words and co-opting them. So they used the word innovation a lot, innovatsiya. They used the word modernizatsiya a lot. So all these words which sort of the democratic forces in Russia had used, these English words, were sort of, you know, like a sponge taken up by the state, and suddenly the opposition found they had no language within which to express their anti sort of government sentiments. And so at the moment, there's this fascinating search among the Russian sort of intelligentsia to find a new language, to use new Western words to express really quite old ideas. So creativne class is one of the ones that has come up. There's actually an institute in Moscow called Stelka, which is an art institute owned by the same enigmatic oligarch who owns Waterstones. Very, very, very strange man. Doesn't talk a lot. But it's right in the middle of Moscow. It's officially an art and architecture institute. It teaches only in English with some translations. The fact that it teaches in English already sort of says a lot about the way it's trying to ferment a certain intellectual class. And they've really very strategically been taking words from urban design, from non-political fields, English words, and trying to put them into the Russian discourse. So just one small example. They brought over a lot of people, a lot of, sort of Western intellectuals who started using the word public space in Russia. It didn't really exist in Russian as a term. They were talking about urban space a lot. They were talking about...
the word in Russian?
Well, this was the thing, because there isn't one really. I mean, there's publичное пространство, but that's not really very good. So there was a search, how do you translate public space into Russian? What they came up with in the end was общественное пространство, which is almost civic space. And that then became one of the clarion calls of protests. Give us back our city, give us back our upshifts, give us our social space almost. So this is what's going on there is very, very interesting. I think actually the most interesting thing that's going on in Russia at the moment is intellectually, because politically there's not much has been achieved with these protests. But what they're doing is they're trying to look very, very actively for a new sort of English terminology to help feed this creative class, which is where I started with. So there you go. So the English words have strange adventures when they get to Russia.
Yes, thank you, Peter. That's very good. Yeah.